Welcome to the second season of Untangled, a series from All Sides and WOSU where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, pull it apart, and weave the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. This season, we're untangling immigration because, let's be honest, immigration feels like a four-letter word.
They're poisoning the blood of our country. That's what they've done.
It's time for the speakers and some of my Republican friends in Congress who are blocking this bill to show a little spine.
Over the next six episodes, we're going to untangle Ohio's immigration laws, what goes on at the immigration court up in Cleveland, how our politicians have helped shape federal laws. We're even dedicating a whole hour to the issue of asylum. We're beginning today with the who, where, and why. Who is coming to Ohio? Where are they living? And why did they come here?
I did not choose to be to come here, so I don't know how the process worked, but they got me here. So they just gave me a schedule, like my planned schedule, when I was back in Africa. And in that planned schedule, they just told me, New York, and then at New York, you're going to Columbus, Ohio. And since I was so excited to just, you know, leave the refugee camp, so I came straight to Columbus, Ohio.
That's Blaise Balaziz. He spent 11 years in a Ugandan refugee camp before being approved to come here to the U.S.
So, I know it's so hard to talk about 11 years in a couple of minutes. But what I can say, just life in refugee camp is the toughest life that a human being can go through. Eating is a problem. There is no medication. There is no jobs. So it's the toughest life. And to survive it, so I saw a lot of people that we came with, you know, from Congo dying there. It's tough. It's really tough.
Blaise had a home in the Democratic Republic of Congo with his parents and his older brother. But the war raging in his country would become the deadliest since World War II, millions dying from a lack of food or health care. And it all hit home, literally, when he was 14.
So my parents, I didn't know where they were because it just came as we just came from school. Nobody was home, and guns everywhere, and then we just ran. So to my aunties to see if I can see my parents there, but they're not there, and then we ran alone.
Oh my!
That's how the scenario was. Yeah.
Oh my gosh! So you were a teenager. You came home from school. Your parents were gone. There was like chaos in your community. And then you fled. Oh my goodness. That has to be, I don't even know if difficult is enough of a word for that.
No, that was terrible. It's something that I really, you know, it's like they're telling you to grab things and you go. How many things you're going to take and where are you going? We didn't know even if where we were going. We were just following other people, you know, and people like, hey, this is the way we'd like to go to Uganda, Rwanda. No, we're not going to go to Rwanda because we felt like Rwandans are the one attacking, you know, the family thing. So we cannot go there. That's the way. So that's how it was. It was terrible. I was young and it was crazy.
Did you find your parents?
Not yet.
Oh. Oh, my goodness. So you still, do you have any idea what happened or where they ended up or just no idea?
I don't have an idea.
Oh my goodness, I can't even imagine when you went to school that morning. Like, had you seen your parents that morning as you were heading to school?
Oh, yes. You know, every morning our mom used to make breakfast, you know, for us. And I remember that day because she did not have money to buy bread for us, so she cooked rice at night. So, and that rice we ate in the morning, like a bread with the tea. So after that tea, I never really have a taste of food again. So that was like a last breakfast meal that I had from her.
He hopes to travel back one day to the DRC, find relatives or people who knew his parents, and finally learn what happened. For now, though, he's adjusting to life in Columbus.
It's a tough moment, but also that's what I do, trying to teach people that we're not here for stealing what people assuming, we're stealing jobs, we're stealing this thing. No, we're here because we don't have any other place to be, and America being so generous to have us here. And we also work harder like everybody else. And we are not any enemy. We are not enemy. We're not here to invade or to take things for, you know. No, we're just here trying to live as a right for all human being.
Blaise Balazs was resettled in Columbus by Community Refugee and Immigration Services, or CRIS. They're a nonprofit that works with the State Department to place refugees here in Central Ohio. CRIS's executive director is Angie Plummer, and she joins me now. Welcome, Angie.
Thank you, Anna. It's nice to be here.
And also at the table is Rob Cohen. He's an immigration attorney at Porter Wright. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here as well.
Angie, Blaise's story is so heartbreaking, but it's not unique when it comes to refugees, is it?
No, tragically, Blaise's story, while very personal, is all too common that we hear from many a refugee group. They each have their own individual stories, but there are many commonalities, like what Blaise described.
Leaving very quickly, war within the country, sort of fleeing with the clothes on your back, all of that is, sounds like it's a through line.
Yeah, sadly, that's very common with many, many people that we work with that are living in Central Ohio as our neighbors.
And he waited 11 years in a refugee camp in Uganda before being cleared to come to the U.S. Is that a typical wait time?
Yes, I would say 11 to 20 is much more common than what people seem to think, that you have a world event and that someone would come within the next year. That's definitely not the typical case. What we saw with Afghans, for example, the evacuation, that was a very unique situation. Most of the time you have refugees who flee their home country and sit in a camp for 10 or 20 years like Blaise did. Most of the Bhutanese Nepali that are here in Columbus, and we have a huge population here, were in a camp for nearly 20 years.
And also, he didn't have a say in where he went. They just gave him a ticket and said, guess what? You're going to Columbus. Does that happen? Like, fairly common that it's just wherever people have space to take them?
It's very common. The way the resettlement process works is that the State Department contracts with 10 national agencies, and each of the 10 have a certain percentage of the pool who are coming in a given year. So this year, the president set the ceiling at 125,000. So our national agency, which is Church World Service, gets about 15% of that pool and has local agencies like ours around the country. So we have a plan at the beginning of the year that we can take certain nationalities because we have staff from those countries. So we have the language.
You speak the language.
Speak the language, know the culture. And so there is a plan in place. If a refugee has someone already in the United States, then they will be predestined to go to that location. So family reunification is one factor that determines where someone goes. But for someone like Blaise, who didn't have someone already here, they go into the pool, and it's almost like dealing cards in Washington, where they give the national agencies a certain number of cases, and they say, well, who can take these brothers from Democratic Republic of Congo? And our representative at the table said, well, Columbus can take those brothers. And so Blaise comes here.
So what nationalities do you currently have capacity to take? Who is coming here?
Well, interestingly, for this fiscal year, we have refugees coming from 25 different countries. The largest are from Afghanistan, 160 so far this fiscal year. So that's since October of 2023, followed by Democratic Republic of Congo. And then followed by that is Somalis. So
all from like Africa and the Middle East.
The big numbers.
The major, yeah.
Yes, but we do have refugees from Sudan, Syria, Uganda, Venezuela. This is new for us, seeing refugees coming from South America. We're also resettling Colombians, also from Central America. So those are some sort of new emerging populations that are being processed as refugees to try to alleviate the pressure at the border. But also many other countries in Africa, seeing Iraqis and Syrians again, too.
And I will say also, Northeast Ohio has been a hub for Ukrainian refugees. So it just sort of depends on where you are and the capacity to take certain nationalities, it sounds like.
Yes, though many of the Ukrainians are on parole status. So that was sort of a special pathway similar to the Afghans in that they didn't come technically in refugee status, but as parolees, this temporary status that we hope will be renewed so that people can make plans, live their lives.
Rob, I want to bring you into the conversation. What is the vetting process like to get here?
So it's obviously we're talking about 10 to 20 years. It's a lengthy process. They are interviewed often several times. There are studies that are done into their background. If there's problems arranging transportation, for example, the authorization may expire, and then they have to do it again. And so, you know, they start over at the beginning of the process. As a practical matter, refugees are the most intensely vetted immigrants that come to the United States.
So they get a lot more of a background check than, say, somebody who presents themselves at a port of entry for asylum.
Yes. Although when someone presents themselves at a port of entry, they too will go through a certain background check. But that's all done while they're here because they've been.
Right.
If they present themselves at a port of entry, usually the southern border, but not always, sometimes at an airport, they apply for asylum. And they're here while that process is taking place.
I want to shift our conversation and talk about the process of resettlement. So once they get off the plane here, because from the moment someone steps off the plane at John Glenn Airport until they can support themselves, I want to talk about how long that process takes, Angie, and so what needs to happen?
So technically, the resettlement period is 90 days, which is wholly insufficient to actually...
I was going to say, can you learn English in that time?
No, you definitely can't. One of the biggest challenges we face is housing. And so we have people dedicated to finding available, affordable housing. That continues to be a challenge. But then there's the task of, as you noted, Anna, learning English and employment programs, getting kids enrolled in school, getting immunizations, all of those things taken care of during those first 90 days. So we have our resettlement program, which is that 90-day period. And then there are other programs that pick up from that 90-day mark through roughly 5 years. So that's assistance with employment, mental health programming.
I was going to say, given what Blaise went through, you might think he would need a little mental health counseling.
Yes. And while being self-sufficient financially is important, it's good to see that in recent years, there's recognition that with all of the mental health challenges that refugees face before they come and through their adjustment, that there are services focused on that. We're pleased to now offer like on-site counseling and have people trained in special trauma counseling practices.
And Rob, the legal process for a refugee doesn't end once they touch down at John Glenn.
Well, it doesn't end, but it's much easier for a refugee than somebody who presents themselves at the border. For the refugee who is admitted under Section 207 of the Immigration Act, and I know that's technical, but we lawyers tend to be very technical, they receive work authorization from day one. They're authorized to work. That doesn't mean that they can find a job. That doesn't mean that they speak English. And
right.
That's what Chris helps them acclimate to where they can get a job. But then after 1 year, they are eligible to apply for permanent residence.
Is that a green card or is that something different?
No, that is a green card.
Okay.
Okay, we use the term, the legal term is lawful permanent residence, or lawful permanent resident. A green card is the vernacular. It's also, the formal term is an immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
It all means the same thing. And after 1 year, they can apply for a green card, immigrant status. And then after 4 years, 4 years beyond that, so 5 years from when they arrived, they can apply for citizenship. It is not a foregone conclusion that either of those will be approved, but they can apply.
Yeah, some of that might be contingent on not getting in trouble here in the United States.
Rule number one. my legal advice to all of my clients is don't break any laws. That's easy.
Don't even speed. Like drive below the limit.
Well, those of us who have speeding tickets can point out that speeding tickets are not. So the legal standard is a crime of moral turpitude.
Mm.
And
so maybe not a parking ticket.
A parking ticket, speeding tickets are not going to prevent you from becoming a citizen. There is a lot of controversy over drunk driving, for example.
Mm.
So as you become more serious, where the offense becomes more serious, then it can be a problem.
You know, I think if Central Ohioans know about refugees here, they probably think of Somali refugees. We have the second largest population of Somali refugees in the United States. How did that happen, Angie? How did they end up coming here?
In some ways, it's really a snowball effect. So somebody was first. I don't know who was first, but there were some firsts, and then applied for family members. Then it's really word gets out that, gosh, this is a very livable place. And eventually there are restaurants to go to and places to shop, and the community is welcoming. And for many, many years, we had available affordable housing, and so that was also a factor. But
that's a little more challenging now.
Yes. Truly, community and family are the biggest pulls. So we take pride in having done a lot of family reunification applications that have seen the children of the have seen many relatives come from those initial years in the early.
The brothers, the sisters, the aunts, the uncles, the grandparents.
Yes. We had a grind to a halt during the Trump administration, but we've seen.
They dropped the legal number of refugees.
Yes, and prohibited a lot of Somalis from coming at that time. So we've finally seen the program working again and are seeing people who have waited in 10 years for family members to come finally arriving now.
Rob, one final question for you. As a refugee, when you're assigned or you're given the ticket to Columbus, are you allowed to then, as you're working through the process, move somewhere else?
Yes, you can. And in fact, there is a certain amount of what we call secondary migration. Chris sees that where we see people from other communities who move to Columbus and come to us for services. But you are not prohibited from moving.
It's not like probation where they're stay in Ohio.
That's correct.
Okay.
Although if you do move within the first 90 days, you might lose the benefit of the resettlement services that you're getting from the agency.
There is I think beginning of May, a new State Department policy that if you do leave the location where you were assigned, you do lose those opportunities to be resettled, that you're sort of on your own.
Gotcha. So most people would probably then at least stay for the first 90 days.
Typically, yes.
Actually, the final question for both of you, as we embark upon this series, Untangling Immigration, what is one thing that you hope people take away or maybe understand? What would be the one takeaway that you would want people to have about refugees here in Central Ohio?
So I take a little bit bigger picture. One of the things that I like to say is that immigrants and refugees are just like people. And I want the general community to understand the humanity of the people that we're dealing with. We're talking about somebody's mother, somebody's daughter or son or brother. There are families with stories like you heard earlier, and we need to have empathy for them. The other takeaway is that immigration is a very broad term. And in my practice, I deal mostly with what we call business immigration, which is very different than refugees. These are highly educated people who are coming to work here.
So I like the Intels, the Nationwides, the like Ohio State professors.
Exactly. Doctors, for example. We represent a lot of doctors. Doctors who work in rural areas. Mm-hmm. And provide medical services to people who would otherwise not have those services. And the other thing that I would say is we are doing a lot of work today with Venezuelans. There's somewhere between 7.5 and 8 million Venezuelans that have fled the country for political and economic reasons. And we are seeing a lot of refugees, not technically refugees, they're mostly applying for political, or not political asylum. But applying for asylum. But there are judges, there's lawyers, there's doctors, there's engineers, there's people from all walks of life, and they are seeking refuge because they want to be able to feed their children and live in a safe environment. And I think we need to have empathy for the humanity of the people that are coming for the safety of living in our country.
That was Rob Cohen, an immigration attorney at Porter Wright. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And thank you to Chris, Executive Director Angie Plummer.
Thank you, Anna.
Coming up, we're going to expand beyond refugees in Central Ohio to guest workers, student visas, and yes, those who are here in Ohio without legal documentation. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides is Untangled, a series where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We spent the first part of the show focused on refugees because Central Ohio is home to a significant number of them, particularly Somali refugees. Now we're shifting to all the other immigrants who call Ohio home. We're going to dive into the data with Steve Hubbard, a data scientist with the American Immigration Council. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So there are lots of different ways people immigrate to the state of Ohio. There are foreign students on visas, foreign workers, people who marry U.S. citizens, investor visas, which is where you spend a ton of money and basically buy yourself permanent residency. There are even special visas for those trafficked here for sex work, asylum seekers who turn themselves in at port of entry, and those who cross the border illegally without getting caught. So it's a lot of different ways that people come to the U.S. and to Ohio. But when you add it all up, all the different kinds of immigrants, about how many people does the American Immigration Council estimate live here in Ohio?
So within Ohio, we know we estimate that there are about 581,000 immigrants or foreign-born residents living in Ohio. And that's about 5%, actually it's technically 4.9% of the population.
That was going to be my next question. So that's, it's not an insignificant chunk of the population that's foreign-born here.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And a very important part to your workforce, I would have to say. Even though it's 5% of the population, when you look at the workforce, it's actually 6% of the population, 6.1% of the population.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that because we have, well, we always say Ohio has an aging population, so we have a lot of retirees, so more of the active workforce. Is that why there's that discrepancy?
Exactly. If you think about it, many immigrants, when they come here at their working age. So when you look at the working age of the immigrant population in Ohio, it's about 77.8% are within that 16 to 64 age range. But when you look at the general population, the U.S. born population in Ohio, it's 6.17% of the population are within that 16 to 64% range.
So let's
age range.
So let's talk about countries of origin. What is the most common country of foreign-born people here in Ohio? I have an idea about this, but I want to hear what you say.
So India is actually...
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's 11% of the immigrants in Ohio are from India. And then the second one would be Mexico, which is 7.7%, followed by China, which is 5%, the Philippines at roughly 3%, and then finally Canada at 2.5%.
Canada?
Yeah.
That's a weird one. Canada, so. I guess it's not that weird. Like, Americans live abroad, Canadians live abroad. But that it's in, like, that top five, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of times people assume, you know, Mexico is much higher, but really we're seeing that across the country. We're seeing more immigrants coming from India, Southeast Asia, such as China and other places across the country. I would say Ohio has a very diverse immigrant population compared to other states. You've got places all over the world, which is great.
So let's talk about level of education, because that's one of those questions we have when we talk about immigration. Do we know how many of them have a college degree? And it could be one gathered abroad or one that they completed here in the United States.
Yeah, so for the population that has a college bachelor's degree, the foreign-born population, 21.7% of the population has a bachelor's. And then compare that to the U.S.-born population, which is 19.3%. So actually, immigrants are slightly higher in the share of with a bachelor's degree.
And
this is the same also for graduate degree. If we look at graduate degrees as well, it's 22.3% of the foreign-born population have graduate degrees. And the U.S.-born population within Ohio, it's 12.1%.
Oh, so almost like double.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really interesting. So speaking of college, which I found fascinating, 31,000 students at Ohio colleges are foreign born. And that's a whole university. I mean, that's like a Division I size university.
Absolutely. International students provide a lot to Ohio. And not just being enrolled in your schools and, you know, being part of your higher education and being part of research and all those different things that are important within higher education. But they also provide economic contributions to the state as well. We estimate that as international students, their economic contribution to the state is $1.2 billion.
Oh my goodness. Is that like tuition, room, board, jobs, food, the whole thing?
The whole thing. Yeah, that's right. And international students, of course, can't access our financial aid. So they have to come in with the money available to them or get, grants or special financial aid, you know, private financial aid for international students. But they do provide a lot to the state.
So the American Immigration Council also estimates the number of people who cross the border illegally each year. So do we have an estimate on how many of them end up here in the state of Ohio?
So if you're talking about your undocumented population, the number of undocumented immigrants within the state is about 112,000. So before I said it's about 581,000 immigrants, so roughly about 20%, 19% are estimating are undocumented. Some of those are part of DACA, obviously. And various other reasons why they're here.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, DACA was the program that is deals with children who are brought across the border by their parents. The idea being that when you're 2, 3, 4, or 5, you don't really have a say in where your parents go.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a great program.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, what's interesting about that is when we talk about immigration, I think we all have something that comes to mind, like an image of an immigrant or what immigration means. But it's interesting to me that 8 out of 10 are here legally in the state of Ohio.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you said 8 out of 10.
So 20%, right? So like 8 out of 10-ish.
Yes, absolutely. Yep, that are here legally, absolutely, yep.
And we're going to be doing a whole episode on asylum seekers later in the season because asylum is a huge part of what we're calling the border crisis currently. But I will say that the system of seeking asylum is chronically understaffed and underfunded. The backlog of cases is about 2 million, and that number gets bigger and bigger every year. So I don't think I'm making any news with the fact that, like, the asylum system is overwhelmed.
Absolutely. Our immigration policy is very outdated. We haven't done much in the past few decades to update it. And, you know, looking at what we need as a country and our workforce and our current population of what we need as we get an older population, because you mentioned Ohio has an older population. Well, we're seeing that as baby boomers get older, they're leaving the workforce. We need more healthcare aides, more people to fill in those jobs. That'll be important. And you know, when someone's hired, it creates more jobs. It brings on the economy. And so that's why immigration and immigrants are so important. And having a sound policy so that we can make sure that we can, you know, have the immigrants in our workforce that we need is really important. And, you know, it's also important, I think, culturally. We gain a lot. If we look at our history, we gained a lot from our immigration in the past. And I think we can do that in the future as well.
So Ohio has its own immigration court up in Cleveland, and it largely serves just the state of Ohio. There's a few exemptions, but it largely serves the people who are seeking asylum in the state of Ohio. And according to data that gets scraped by Syracuse University, the number one country that asylum seekers come from who live in Ohio is Guatemala. So 16% of the cases processed by the court in the last 2 decades were Guatemalan. The second was El Salvador at number 2. And the third surprised me. It was Mauritania in Africa. Maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but I was kind of surprised that Mauritania.
Yeah, you know, I don't have, I'm glad you have those numbers in front of you, but when we look at refugees, they come from all over the world. And it's important both in our international relations and what we do as a country, but also important into our culture. A lot of times refugees become entrepreneurs. They're part of the workforce. We know in refugees in Ohio, 97.1% are employed. The employment rate of likely refugees is 97.1%, which is very high. So they are working, being part of the economy. And when we look at them becoming naturalized citizens, refugees, because once they come here, they can, you know, be part of that naturalization process. We estimated that 78.3% of refugees are naturalized citizens.
You know, El Salvador didn't surprise me at number 2, given all the research that I've been putting into this series. Next Monday at 11 a.m., we're going to be doing the history of immigration. I've been saying 100 years in an hour, so no small task. But, yeah, you know, we often categorize, because they come across the Mexican border, as largely Mexican, but you know, when you look at Ohio, Guatemala, El Salvador, these are people crossing through Mexico, not people coming from Mexico.
Absolutely. That's right. Yes, it is. We're seeing that Mexico, as far as nationally, is decreasing slightly, you know, slowly in the number of immigrants coming across the country. As I said before, certainly Asia, India and Southeast Asia is increasing, as well as Central and South America. We are seeing immigrants as well coming across.
And I will say that when we get to the politics of immigration, we'll talk about the fact that Mexico now has a new president, a female president, and what that may mean for how we negotiate immigration policy going forward. But final question for you, Steve, is what I'm going to be asking everyone this series, which is, what would you want people to take away from what we've been talking about? What either do you think people should keep in mind or think about as they really spend some time with what immigration means here in Ohio?
So I think the biggest thing is your occupation, your workforce. Those immigrants are so important to the workforce. When we look at the top shares of immigrants, of where they are in the workforce, so as far as manicurists and pedicurists in Ohio, it's about 47.5%. That's the highest as far as occupation. But when we look at the second one, it's physical scientists. And of the physical scientists in Ohio, 31.3% are immigrants.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. And then we get into, packers, of course, that's important for manufacturing, 29.8%. Are immigrants. And then the fourth one is physicians. I think this is really important to talk about. It's about healthcare. And when we look at physicians in Ohio, 26.9% of physicians, over one in four, are immigrants. And I come from Iowa originally, and my parents live in Iowa. They live in a very rural part of Iowa, and they have to drive an hour or even, no, almost 2 hours to go to see a specialist. And that is something I think, we have to think about, especially in like rural areas and other places, our places in healthcare being served, and how can we better serve those people in rural areas, with healthcare when there's such a, the shortage in healthcare industry right now is so, decreasing, and we need more healthcare workers. And immigration is one way to think about doing and solving that.
I want to repeat that stat just to make sure I heard you correctly. One in four Ohio doctors is foreign born.
Yep, 26.9%.
Wow. That is really quite something to think about. That was Stephen Hubbard, a data scientist with the American Immigration Council. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, brain waste, education, and how well Ohio is or maybe isn't assimilating its legal immigrants. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides is Untangled, a series where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're untangling immigration this season, and we've started by learning who is coming into Ohio and where they're settling. Now we're going to turn to some demographic trends. And for that, we're joined by Julia Gillat, Associate Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute. Welcome to All Sides, Julia.
Thanks for having me on.
So regardless of what you think about how immigrants should be treated in this country, the fact is this winter was a record-breaking number across the border. Border crossings dropped during COVID, which makes total sense, but then they spiked last year. Do we have a sense of why? Is it just a buildup of people waiting for COVID to end?
I think there are a number of reasons. One is pent-up demand from the COVID era, but also the U.S. economy has been booming. It came roaring back after the pandemic. Employers are looking for workers across a wide range of sectors, and immigration increases when there are jobs available. There are also a lot of push factors in countries in the region and around the world. Some of the economies in the region haven't done as well. There's higher unemployment and even higher inflation in the US. Of course, there are governments that people are fleeing from in Venezuela, in Nicaragua, in Cuba. Haiti is overrun by gang violence. So there are a lot of reasons people want to leave home, and people want to come to the United States because of the economic opportunity and the safety available here.
One of the things that the Migration Policy Institute studies is something called brain waste, which is when a college-educated immigrant gets stuck working a lower-skilled job. So a doctor maybe works as a custodian, for example. And I know it's been a minute since you guys looked at Ohio, but in 2016, your organization estimated that 20% of Ohio's college-educated immigrants weren't using their training. Is that about right overall, like the number of immigrants who perhaps have skills beyond what they're working in?
There are hundreds of thousands of college-educated immigrants in the United States who either aren't employed or are working in jobs that don't require that college degree that they have. This happens for a variety of reasons. It can happen because people don't have yet the English proficiency needed to take advantage of their credentials. It can happen because they don't have legal work authorization in the United States. But probably the most common reason is that people's skills and credentials aren't well recognized. There are a lot of jobs in the United States, even things you might not expect, like cutting hair or being a barber, that require some kind of professional license. Some of those are easier for foreign-born people to obtain based on their education and training and experience abroad. And some of those, like becoming a doctor in the United States, are incredibly difficult. Even if someone was a top doctor in their home country, it's really difficult for them. They almost have to start over here in the United States.
One of the things I found fascinating from that 2016 report was back then, the Migration Policy Institute estimated that Ohio was losing about $500 million in lost revenue and about $53 million in lost taxes just from that. Those immigrants who perhaps could have higher paying jobs but weren't able to get them for all the reasons that you just listed. So it is an economic issue at its heart, right? About matching foreign-born workers with the skills that match their experience.
Right. It's the tax revenues that the country is losing out on. It's also that there are certain fields where there's a really high need, and there are actually people here who probably have the skills and the training, but we do a pretty poor job of recognizing those skills. So there are, you know, communities in the United States that really need doctors, and there are foreign trained doctors who would be happy to fill those jobs, but they don't have the ability to do it. The same thing with some nursing jobs, the same thing in, you know, a wide range of fields, from, you know, skilled trades to many others.
I was even thinking of like hairdresser and like other occupations. Like, we have certain number of hours that you have to complete at certain kinds of schools. The tests are complicated and long. So even something as simple as getting like a license to cut hair can, I would think, could be complicated for somebody who's still learning English.
That's right. And, you know, for many jobs, there are kind of college and community college pathways, but they're not well set up for people who are coming from abroad who may already have the skills, but they need to reprove it. But they might not have the English skills, or they might not have kind of the prerequisites. So we put people through very long pathways to kind of reprove things that they've already proven that they have the ability to do.
I want to talk a little bit about English language learners, because federal law does require that public schools be held accountable for the success of all students, including English language learners. But you all took a pretty deep dive not too long ago into how well that's playing out. So what are some of the challenges for English learners in K through 12 education?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the challenges is properly identifying who the kids are and what level of help that they need, and making sure that they're still able to continue the rest of their content education, even as they're learning English. And then, you know, providing that English education in an evidence-based way, and making sure that families from a really diverse set of backgrounds and languages are well accommodated. And then schools also really struggle to engage immigrant parents in their children's education. Parents are coming with a wide variety of experiences in their home country and a wide variety of languages and, you know, levels of English proficiency. And that is a challenge for schools. And often schools are kind of figuring things out on their own rather than building on best practices available.
But ultimately, I think especially when it comes to refugees and all the various forms of legal immigration, we're really focused on making them part of the community. And I want to play a clip from Blaise Belazis. He's a refugee that we heard from at the beginning of the hour. He came from the Democratic Republic of Congo and spent 11 years in a Ugandan refugee camp before getting a plane ticket to Columbus.
As the government keep opening door for more refugees here, it's just something that I can wish, you know, other people to also get the chance to go and work and have a meal from themselves, you know, and have a freedom. At least they have a home. Like now I call Ohio my home, and I wish like people who are in refugee camp can also have a home like I have now.
You feel lucky to be here.
Yeah, I feel lucky, yes. That's the word.
Do you find that that's kind of like that's the general disposition of immigrants here, that they feel lucky to be here?
I think in the majority of cases, yes. Sometimes I think that the most patriotic people in the United States are immigrants who really, you know, don't take for granted the freedoms that we have here, the freedom of speech and expression, the safety, the rule of law that we have. Yes, there are challenges sometimes, but, you know, we really have, and the economic opportunity most of all. You know, it can be difficult for new immigrants to come if they've left a lot behind. They may have come through pretty harrowing pathways to the United States, and integrating into a new country, learning a new language, you know, getting your feet under you again can be really challenging, and figuring out how to socially integrate. But yes, there is a lot that the United States offers for immigrants, and we actually make it hard for people to come here, but the draw of the United States is so strong that people will navigate these really tortured immigration pathways to come here because of the opportunities that we offer.
You know, one of the things that Blaise said was that there weren't jobs in the refugee camp, and that he was really excited to come here because he could work. He could pay for his housing, for his food, for having that sense of self-sufficiency. And I want to talk a little bit about Ohio, because Ohio is an aging state. And while the issues that bring that having an aging population brings may be felt acutely here at home, the U.S. overall is struggling with what happens when baby boomers retire and birth rates continue to decline, right? So how are immigrants expected to help with that?
Yeah, we are an aging country, and our labor force is aging. And we actually looked at over the past 23 years, how much of the growth in our working age population and in our labor force came from immigrants, so people born abroad, and then from their US born children. And these groups, immigrants and their US born children, contributed to all of the growth in our labor force over
all
the past
it.
23 years. All of it.
All of it. Oh my goodness. So it's not even like 80-90%. Yeah, it's like all of it.
All of it. It's not all direct immigration, but if those immigrants hadn't come and had their children here, our working age population would be shrinking, our labor force would be shrinking. So immigration is key to our continued economic growth and our economic future across the United States. But I don't think that that has yet really made it into our national conversations about immigration. I think we deal with the border and we think about our economy as two completely separate things, and we don't think about the intersection between immigration and economic growth.
Yeah, and it also gives a new sense of urgency, I think, to what we were talking about earlier in terms of educating this particular population, ensuring that they can work to the full ability of their skill set.
That's right. Investments in immigrants, investments in children of immigrants are investments in the future of our country and our democracy and our economy and in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, and I will say about 3 million Ohioans don't have any education beyond high school, and 11% of them are foreign born. And it is one of those conversations that we just continue to have about what the workforce of tomorrow will bring. You know, here in Central Ohio, we just, well, within the last couple of years, we won a major contract with Intel, right? They're building a huge semiconductor chip manufacturing plant. It's going to bring thousands of jobs. And one of the difficult conversations that we've been having is how many of those will be filled by foreign-born workers. Basically, does Ohio actually have enough people trained to take the jobs?
Yeah, that's right. I think across a lot of kind of cutting edge technology, these kinds of industries create a lot of jobs, but there can be bottlenecks, especially on kind of the highest skilled end for people who have very, very specialized skills. We may or may not have trained up those people here in the United States. And so what industry experts seem to be saying is that if you bring in foreign workers to fill some of those small number of really specialized jobs, that can create more jobs that are middle skill jobs that could employ a lot of US born people in semiconductor and other industries. And so, yeah, I think that thinking about kind of how can we keep innovating and how can immigrants play a role in also job creation for US born workers is something that will be really important looking ahead.
Final question, and we have just under a minute. What is something that you would want people to take away from this series about immigration?
I think one thing that gets lost is just that we have a whole lot of legal immigration happening. There's so much attention at the border, but so many people are coming through all kinds of legal pathways to work for U.S. employers, to join their family members here because they fell in love with a U.S. citizen. And they're contributing in all kinds of ways to our communities, to our economy, to the strength of our country. So I just hope that we can have a full conversation about all the ways that immigrants come to this country.
That was Julia Gillette, Associate Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you.
Thank you.